starting Unit 2 now, meaning the second test's worth of material. And we'll start off with the skeletal system, in case you haven't already figured that out. Before we get into the actual material on this first slide, let's talk about the various functions of the organ system. What can you tell me are functions of the skeletal system?
To support them.
Yeah, definitely it's support is a major function. It's the framework for the body. It's the hard part, so it's the framework. What else besides support? Right, it's protective, definitely, especially in the rib cage area, right? Enclosing some pretty important things. And the brain case, or the cranium of the skull, is obviously protective of the most important organ, the one that makes you, you, the brain. What else? Well, muscles move the skeleton, so yes, movement of the body is an important function of the skeletal system, because if the skeletal system didn't have stiff bones for the muscles to pull on, the muscles would just pull on, you know, we would just be a writhing mass. We wouldn't be able to move around. So they provide something for the muscles to pull on. There are still others. Anything else? Well, those are the more obvious ones. The skeleton is also important in breathing, because muscles pull on the ribs, and those ribs move out to the side and move out toward the front, and that increases the volume of when the muscles pull on the bones, the ribs then pull on the pleurae, which are the serous membranes covering the lungs, and that expands the lungs, which reduces the pressure inside them until it's below pressure, atmospheric pressure, and then that higher pressure outside forces air into the lungs. And then when you relax those muscles, it springs back into place, decreasing the volume of the lungs, which increases the pressure in the lungs, and it reverses the flow, lets you exhale. Another thing is that obviously the skeleton is made of hard stuff, right? Hardest part of the body. Well, actually, the hardest part is the teeth. Enamel is the hardest substance in the body. But bony material is really hard as well. And chemically speaking, that bony material is hydroxyapatite. That's the stuff. But the major, chemically, as far as elements are concerned, or as far as the substance hydroxyapatite is concerned, it's mostly calcium phosphate. Phosphate is an ion, and calcium ions can bind ionically to phosphate to form calcium phosphate. That's the chief component of hydroxyapatite, which makes the skeleton hard. So that's important just for the skeleton, for the hardness of the skeleton. But calcium and phosphate on their own as ions are really important for the rest of the body as well. Without calcium ions, a lot of things would be impossible, including the beating of the heart. The movement of any skeletal muscle relies on calcium ions, and calcium ions just are general signals for a lot of things in different kinds of cells. And phosphate, can't live without phosphate for many reasons, including that phosphate is a chief component of phospholipids, which make up plasma membranes of all cells, right? And there's many other reasons why you need phosphate. So aside from having calcium phosphate in the bones for the hardness of the bones themselves, a major function of the skeleton is to serve as a huge reservoir or store of calcium and phosphate. And, you know, when the, for instance, calcium level in the blood needs to be a certain level. It's just part of homeostasis. If that level gets low, then the skeleton will receive a signal to start tearing a little bit of that material down to free up the calcium and put it into the blood to bring it back up to normal levels. And if it gets too high in the blood, then the skeleton will be signaled to take some of that calcium out of the blood and put it into hydroxyapatite form, store it in the skeleton. Yeah?
I'm sorry, did you say that it stores both calcium phosphate or just calcium?
Both calcium and phosphate in the form of calcium phosphate.
Okay.
But if you break down calcium phosphate, you get both of those ions, whichever one you need. Another important function of the skeleton is hemopoiesis. Now, you might not have heard this term before. It usually doesn't come up in conversation. But anyone know what this means? What about the hemo part of it? Blood, yes. Hemopoiesis is the name for the production of blood cells, which is an important job, of course. Well, that occurs within bones, in the marrow of bones, which is in the interior spaces. All blood cells, not just red blood cells, white blood cells as well, that are come in five varieties. All blood cells start out in the marrow within the skeleton. So those are major functions of the skeletal system as an organ system. Let's talk about bone tissue now with this first slide. Although chemically it's all the same stuff, there are two kinds of bone, two categories of bone tissue, compact bone and spongy bone, as you see here. And compact bone gets its name because there's much less space in compact bone, and therefore it is much denser and stronger. And compact bone is the only type of bone that you'll see if you look at a bone that's intact. You won't see spongy bone unless you cut into the bone, because it's deeper. The superficial layer on any bone is compact bone, and then deep to that is the spongy bone, just like you see in this cutaway view of the skull. So it's not just in the skull that this is true. Spongy bone's in the middle of all the bones. And don't be confused by the word spongy. It doesn't mean that it's easy to compress like a sponge. It's not. It's hard stuff. Stays in place. But it has a lot of pores in it, a lot of holes, so it looks like a sponge only. Those holes, by the way, make it a lot lighter, even though it's still strong. The holes are really just spaces in between a bunch of tiny beams, beam-like structures, like making up a scaffold. These beams are called trabeculae, which is the plural of trabecula. If you add an E on it, it's trabeculae. That word means little beam. So they're like little scaffolding beams that when you weld them all together, it makes a very rigid structure without actually being so heavy as it would be if it were compact bone with no space. Right? Because the heavier we make the skeleton, yes, it does get a little stronger, but it also is now a lot more hard to move around if it's heavy. And that requires more energy in the form of food, which over evolutionary time has been scarce. But there's another important reason for all these holes. That's where marrow is. And so I was talking about the marrow earlier in terms of hemopoiesis. Actually, there's two kinds of marrow, red marrow and yellow marrow. Red marrow is where the blood cells are created. That's where hemopoiesis occurs. Yellow marrow is mostly fat. Storage of fat. Let's go on to the second slide and talk about bone shapes. Any given bone is just roughly categorized based on its shape. Some of them are long bones, like the humerus you see here, or the femur is even longer. I'm sure you know what long means. It's pretty self-explanatory. Some are flat bones, like the sternum. Some are short bones. They're not particularly long in any dimension. And so the ankle bones are the tarsal bones, as they're called, and the wrist bones or carpal bones are good examples of short bones. And then some just don't really fit into any of those three categories, so they are lumped into a catch-all miscellaneous category called irregular bones. And vertebrae, as you see a vertebra right here, the vertebrae are good examples of that. They're pretty weirdly shaped. So those are the four categories. In slide 3, we're looking at a long bone, and this one happens to be the humerus, but this would be true for any long bone, like the femur as well. In a long bone, there are three regions in that bone. The long part, everything except the two tips, is called the diaphysis. And then each tip, one at either end, is called an epiphysis. So a long bone has a diaphysis and two epiphyses, as the plural is pronounced. And the reason that's important is because long bones, bones in general, but long bones grow, right? The skeleton you have now is bigger than the skeleton you had when you were born. And so in a long bone, that growth means getting longer. Bones are not hard to begin with. Your first skeleton, the skeleton you were that you developed before you were born, was not bony yet. It wasn't hard, but it was made of cartilage instead. Almost all of it. Some of it was other connective tissue, but it starts out as tough stuff, just not solid like bone is, and then it solidifies by becoming bony material. That's called ossification. And you can't completely ossify the skeleton at around birth, or you wouldn't be able to get bigger. So in long bones, as we see here, you have solidification in the diaphysis, and you have some solidification in the epiphyses, ossification that is. But this is a mature bone. This is after age 20 or so. Before, while you're still growing, for the first 2 decades of your life, this epiphyseal line doesn't exist. It's called an epiphyseal plate when it's still growing because it's still cartilage. And when it's still cartilage, new material can be laid down. And so there's a line down here, a plate down here as well, one between each epiphysis and the diaphysis. And new material is added toward the diaphysis end, and that makes it longer and longer as you get older. And then once you hit, on average, about age 20, you stop growing, and those epiphyseal plates, which were cartilage, actually ossify themselves, turn into solid bone. That's when they're called epiphyseal lines. And however big you've gotten staturally at that time, however big your skeleton is at that time, that's as big as you're ever going to get. Another thing we see here is, since this is a cutaway view, that just as I was saying before, it's not just the skull that has compact bone superficial to spongy bone. That's for any bone. And usually in bones that are thicker than the skull, like this humerus, you have a pretty open internal area, deep area called the medullary cavity. Notice it uses the same word. Medulla on the hair was the deepest part. That's true for the bones as well. So this can fit a lot more marrow in it than the tinier spaces in the spongy bones of the epiphyses. Okay. If we look at slide 4, now we're looking at a closer up view. You get a much better view of these trabeculae that I was talking about, these little beams. They're all connected to each other. And by the way, it's tempting, since the skeleton is hard, it's tempting to think that once it's built, it's permanent and unchanging. Well, that's not true at all. Just like any part of the body, it's dynamic. It's always changing. Part of that change I've already mentioned, right? You build material when you need to take calcium out of the blood. You break down material when you need to put that calcium back in. But also the bones are continuously being partially destroyed and rebuilt. And that includes these trabeculae. For instance, if you play a sport or whatever, and you're suddenly exerting a lot more force on a bone in a certain direction, or if you gain weight, for instance, same thing, your body will respond by putting more trabeculae in that area, arranged in the right direction for it to withstand that greater stress. So it's all bone is highly dynamic, even though it's solid. It's continuously being rebuilt. You can see that the compact bone layer, the superficial part, is made up of osteons. This shouldn't surprise you because you've already looked at compact bone in several slides for quite a while last couple weeks. And you see these familiar round structures that are osteons. Each one is an osteon. And they're like long cylinders. We're seeing the ends of them. But each osteon has a central canal, which is a passageway, as you see, for blood vessels and nerves. And then blood vessels also go through the spaces in the spongy bone as well. Five is an even closer view of just part of an osteon. This gives you a better view of the fact that one osteon is made of several layers of hard stuff surrounding that central canal. Those are called lamellae, the plural of lamella, which simply means layer. And what are these orangish things with the purple dots? You can cheat and look, but what do they look like?
Cells.
They're cells, right. They're osteocytes, which literally means bone cell. Well, what kind of tissue is bone? Connective tissue. It's just one of many connective tissues, right? But remember I said that any connective tissue, bone included, consists of two major parts. Some cells of some sort, a cellular component in other words, and a bunch of stuff outside of the cells, between the cells, that collectively is called the extracellular matrix, right? That's true for any connective tissue. And there are three major kinds of cells in connective tissues that are called blasts, cytes, and clasts. Now, blasts are cells whose job it is to create the extracellular matrix material. Because that stuff has to be built in a living cell and then exported out between the cells. That's what blasts do. They eventually make enough to fill in the spaces between the cells, and even though it's the same cell, once it's mature, we call it a cyte. And the cyte's job is to, which means cell, as I've said, the cyte's job is to maintain the extracellular matrix. And then clasts are slightly different kinds of cells with a different function. Their job is to degrade the extracellular matrix, break it down when necessary. So you have these in different kinds of connective tissue. If the specific connective tissue is bone, which we're looking at right now, then there are osteocytes, osteoblasts, and osteoclasts. So the osteoblasts build that hard extracellular matrix containing hydroxyapatite, like I was saying. Then when there's enough, when they're done building it, basically, it's the same cell, but we now call it an osteocyte. And that's what we see here. Remember, locked in its own, each one is locked in its own lacuna, or little lagoon, just the space that it occupies. It's not really a structure. Osteoclasts are the ones that will be spurred on by the signal from the body that the blood calcium level has dropped too low, That will tell osteoclasts, okay, your job is to break down some of that hydroxyapatite to free up some calcium for the blood. Okay, let's go to 6. This is something that should really be familiar to you because you've looked at pictures exactly like, not pictures, you've looked at slides that look exactly like this picture of a slide. So you should definitely recognize this as bone tissue. You see clearly an osteon with its concentric lamellae. The dark spots are the osteocytes locked in lacunae, and this is the central canal. Now in 7, we see a little bit about what I was telling you before, namely that your skeleton doesn't start out hard. It starts out as still tough, but not nearly as tough material. Mostly cartilage, or by mostly I mean most of the skeleton starts out as cartilage. The bones of your skull start out as connective tissue membranes, but it's basically the same consistency as cartilage. And the rest of it that starts out as cartilage is specifically hyaline cartilage. Remember, there's different kinds of cartilage. Hyaline cartilage, the good example on an adult skeleton is this costal cartilage, as it's called. Costal, C-O-S-T-A-L, means of the ribs, because it's associated with the ribs. Well, hyaline cartilage remains cartilage throughout your life. But the rest of the bones were that same material originally, and in the shape of the bone to be, or the hard bone to be, but still pliable. And you can see that in the embryo on the left. This has the shape of a bone, but it's made of cartilage, and it's just starting to harden a little bit in the diaphysis, as you see here. That's the ossification taking place. Still, most of it, though, is not nearly as strong as it's going to be because it's still cartilage. And then more and more of the diaphysis ossifies, and you start getting ossification in each epiphysis as well. But notice that there's still cartilage between the hard part of the epiphysis and the hard part of the diaphysis. And this is what I was talking about before. While you're still growing, much longer than just after birth, up until you're about 20, you have this epiphyseal plate still as cartilage that allows this thing to get longer and longer if it keeps adding cells toward the diaphysis in the center. Once that ossifies, though, it'll be called an epiphyseal line, like we saw in that previous slide, and however big it is, that's as big as it's going to get. Slide 8 illustrates this, even though you don't really see the addition of new cells, that is occurring at the epiphyseal plate. And so when more and more cells are added this way, the whole epiphysis moves upward and the diaphysis gets longer. Right? You can imagine that basically. That's bone growth. A similar slide, number 9, shows bone remodeling. Now, bone growth means just what you think. The new material is added because it hasn't gotten to its full size yet. Bone remodeling is something different. And this happens throughout your lifetime, not just when you're growing. Bone remodeling is what I was talking about earlier when I said that the skeleton is continuously being partially destroyed and rebuilt all the time. That's what bone remodeling is. So it's kind of like making a huge Lego model, and then every day you take certain bricks out and add new ones to replace them. That's kind of what bone remodeling is. It's not the same stuff day to day, even though it looks basically the same. And that involves, since that involves tearing old stuff down and adding new stuff, that's going to involve both osteoclasts to tear it down and then osteoblasts to build new stuff. Nine is something a little bit different. Both growth and remodeling occur if nothing ever goes wrong with your skeleton. But sometimes we can break a bone. I never have, but probably many of you have broken a bone, or probably some of you at least, maybe not many. But anyway, if you break a bone, that's an important thing to heal correctly. Otherwise, your skeleton will be impaired for the rest of your life. And the skeleton does a good job of healing after a fracture. But it happens in these four stages that we're seeing here. The first thing is to form what's called a hematoma, which really just means a big blood clot. So the fracture itself severs a bunch of those small vessels that are running through the bone we were talking about earlier. That causes bleeding. That bleeding, just like if it were happening when you cut your skin, is going to scab up. But that big blood clot or scab is called a hematoma. And that's really, that's definitely not as strong as it needs to be, obviously. But the hematoma gets something in place immediately, kind of as a stopgap measure. Gives a little bit of support to it. You won't be able to use the bone still, or it'll just break again. But it gets the ball rolling, basically, to form the hematoma. And then, once that clot is formed, eventually, little by little, the blood clot will be replaced with fibrocartilage, as you see here. The hematoma gets replaced by fibrocartilage, which is much stronger than just a blood clot. But it's still obviously not strong as bony material, so after the fibrocartilage forms, and this is while you're in a cast, basically, not using the bone, then the fibrocartilage ossifies, turns into bony material, mineralizes, so that hydroxyapatite makes it hard. And that will make it usable, but it's still not complete. It's now strong, but you can tell that it's different from how it looked originally. And so once it's strong enough, then the body can get to the finer details of remodeling it into how it was originally. Okay, so what's called a bony callus of hard stuff is broken down little by little without weakening it and remodeled into the correct shape so that you have a bone that is sometimes very difficult to tell it's ever been broken. But notice, yeah, go ahead.
So if someone were to have like osteogenesis imperfecta, would they just like not go through that process? Or?
I wouldn't say that they wouldn't go through the process at all, but each step would be incomplete. And so, yeah, the bone would be much weaker as a result. Now, speaking of weakness, even on this final version on the right, you can see that it kind of bulges. It's kind of thicker. The layer of compact bone, which is the exterior part, is a little thicker right where the fracture occurred. And so that's true in general. When you heal well from a fracture, the place where the fracture occurred ends up being stronger than it was originally. Although that doesn't mean you should go out and break all your bones to get a stronger skeleton, but that does happen, though. Okay, let's look at the overall skeleton in 11 and talk about its two major subdivisions. This is obviously the overall skeleton, but there's two major parts to it, one of which is shown in green here on this slide, or the greenish cyan or whatever color that is. The greenish part is called the axial skeleton, which is an adjective of axis, right? The long axis of the body, right down the middle, is what this axial skeleton is named for. And so it includes just the stuff that's right in the middle, right on the midline, which is the skull. Inferior to the skull, but still in the middle, is the vertebral column, made up of many vertebrae, sometimes called the spine, but vertebral column is the better phrase. And also the ribs, which are centrally placed. Okay, those major things together collectively make up the axial skeleton. What is the rest of the skeleton called? The rest of it is called the appendicular skeleton. Appendicular is the adjective of appendix, right? An appendix is something that you append or add on to something that's already there. Like the appendix that's added on to the colon, right? In your abdomen. But the appendix in a book is added on at the end. And so the appendicular skeleton consists of all things that are appended onto or attached to that axial skeleton, including things that we call appendages, right? Same word. The appendages are the limbs, but the appendicular skeleton, even though it includes limbs, includes a little bit more than that. Everything in kind of yellowish bony color here, everything but the green, is the appendicular skeleton. So it consists of the upper limbs and the lower limbs, but also the two collarbones, which are properly called the clavicles, and from the rear view, the two shoulder blades, which are properly called the scapulae, singular is scapula. Those, by the way, not only are they part of the appendicular skeleton, the clavicles and the scapulae, when you consider those four bones together, which form not a complete ring, but mostly a ring around the neck, the fact that they form a ring qualifies them as a girdle. A girdle is something that wraps around something. And so there are two girdles in the skeleton. The one at the around the neck is called the pectoral girdle. So the two clavicles and the two scapulae make up the pectoral girdle. And they're part of the appendicular skeleton. There's the other girdle does form a complete ring. You can see the ring right here. That's called the pelvic girdle. But be careful with that, because the pectoral girdle has all four bones are members of the appendicular skeleton. The pelvic girdle has made up of three bones overall. Two of those bones, which are these ones, the pelvic bones, those are really called oscoxae. Oscoxa is the singular, but you have two, so it's oscoxae. Those oscoxae are members of the appendicular skeleton, as you see. But the third part of the pelvic girdle is this bone right here, which is the sacrum. That's part of the axial skeleton. Now, when you use the word limb, remember that limb, for instance, the upper limb, that's not an interchangeable phrase. It's not a synonym for arm, right? Upper limb and arm are not the same thing. The arm is really just part of the upper limb, right? What is the arm? Which part? No, that's not the arm. That's the forearm. The arm is only from shoulder to elbow, anatomically. So this is the upper limb. It includes the arm. Anyone know the other name for the arm, the anatomical name for the arm? This goes back to the first day, I think. The arm is called the brachium. That's why this muscle is called the biceps brachii. Okay, so that's part of the upper limb, the brachium. What is the forearm also called? Well, forearm means before the arm, right? Another way of saying that is antebrachium. Because ante means before. Like before you bet, you ante in the pot, right? Before you deal the cards. Or antipasto, before the pasta. So that's the name for the forearm. Well, in each upper limb, there's only one arm bone, the brachial bone, that is the humerus. There are two in the antebrachium. We're going to look at these bones individually in a minute, but this is all part of the upper limb, right? More than just the arm. And then you have, distal to that, the hand. Anyone remember the name of the hand? No, that's just part of the hand. What is the what's the adjective that means by hand?
Manual.
That's the adjective form of manus, which is the anatomical name for the hand. And be careful with wrist, because outside of anatomy classes, people call this the wrist. This is not the wrist, this is part of your forearm, part of the antebrachium. The wrist is the proximal part of the hand. It's part of the hand. So the wrist bones are in here. And that wrist overall is called the carpus, which is why the bones of the wrist are called carpal bones. Okay? And then, so the overall hand, or manus, consists of three major kinds of bones, and we'll look at those in detail a little bit later, but actually, we see them here, too, so I might as well tell you. Carpal bones make up the wrist. The palm, don't mistake these for fingers, those are in here. The palm is made up of metacarpals, which literally means beyond the carpals. Meta means beyond. And then the fingers themselves, or the digits, are made up of bones called phalanges. That's a plural. But there is no such word, phalange. People say this all the time. The singular of phalanges is phalanx. Anyone know this word from military usage? A phalanx of soldiers is a way of lining up soldiers during warfare. And that's why these bones were called that, because they're lined up like soldiers. So they're phalanges, though. So that's the rest of the limb, the upper limb. The lower limb, remember, doesn't really correspond to the upper limb. What I mean is that the leg is not the proximal part. The arm is the proximal part of the upper limb. But the proximal part of the lower limb is called what? What is this part? That's the bone, but I mean the whole limb is, what is this part? The thigh, right. So you have the thigh proximally, and then the leg is from knee down to foot. Okay? Just by analogy, though, with the upper limb, the ankle is not right here. This is still part of the leg. The ankle is part of the foot, just like the wrist is part of the hand. What, by the way, is the anatomical name for the foot? Pedis. So pedal or pedal means of the foot. And just like the proximal part of the manus or hand is the carpus or wrist, the proximal part of the pedis, or foot, is the ankle, which is the tarsus. And that's why bones of the ankle, or bones of the tarsus, are called tarsal bones. Okay, there are metatarsals beyond that, just like there are metacarpals beyond the carpals. The metatarsals are the bones in the arch of your foot. And then the toes themselves, the digits, just like the fingers, consist of bones called phalanges. Now, slide 12 is just a rear view of all of this stuff, but you can see the axial skeleton versus the appendicular skeleton. How many bones overall are in a human? In a normal human, I should say. A little too many. 200 something, but that's not quite specific enough. Actually, the answer depends on when you're talking about in that person's lifetime. Because we're born with more bones than we eventually have. Some bones fuse together and they're then considered one bone once they're totally bony material. For instance, there's two halves of the lower jawbone, which is the mandible. It starts out as two halves, but it solidifies together. So in adulthood, it's considered one bone. Same with the frontal bone. There's one frontal bone. But it starts out as two halves when you're a fetus, and those grow together. So it actually decreases, but for a normal human in adulthood, there are 206 bones. And interestingly, 206 total, over half of those bones, 106, are in just your feet and hands. And over a quarter of those bones, 56 bones, just in your fingers and toes. So 56 phalanges overall. Which makes sense because your digits are what you manipulate things. That manipulate has the same manus, right? To manipulate means to use your hands on something. Well, those need to be moved delicately so that you can do a lot of things carefully. If you only had big bones and not many of them, you wouldn't have nearly as much dexterity, right? So you have a bunch of little bones with joints between them, and they can undergo a lot of different movements. When we look at slide 13, which is an x-ray of a fetus, we can see that the skeleton is hardening, but it hasn't completed yet. So all the dark spots, that's bony material. All the lighter spots is still cartilage. And so even at birth, you're not nearly hardened all the way. As you probably already know, babies have soft spots in the skull, for instance. Well, it's not their only soft spots, but it's ones we pay particular attention to because you definitely don't want to injure the brain. So you have to be really careful with the baby's head. Do anyone remember what those soft spots are called officially? Well, it's not actually hyaline cartilage. It's dense connective tissue, membranes for the skull. Pretty much the rest of the skeleton is hyaline cartilage. But what I mean is just another name for soft spots themselves in the skull. That's fontanelles. I think that's probably the next picture. Yeah, in slide 14, you can see fontanelles between what will eventually be bones that come together to form a complete hard brain case or cranium. But that takes a while after birth. So these soft spots are still places of vulnerability where you can damage what it's covering, which is the brain, pretty important organ. Another view of those fontanelles is shown in 15, just the top view. But you get a good view of this pretty big fontanelle right here in a newborn baby. That is the kind of arrow shape I was talking about earlier that is the basis for naming this joint that eventually forms. Joints in the skull are called sutures. This one was named the sagittal suture because this looks like an arrow. And that's why the plane that goes through that was therefore called the sagittal plane. Sagitt means arrow. Okay, now we've gotten through an overview of the organ system. The rest of the slideshow is really just an indication of the bones that you have to know. And notice I've grayed out many of these and made some of them red. The red ones are on your list. So your official list, you don't have to know every bone's name, not all 206. But if you look at your manual, today when we do lab, which this directly pertains to, you'll be starting on page 77. Well, on 78 is your official bone list. So let's take a look at these. I'll introduce them as a class, and then you can go through them during lab on your own with each other. We're looking at the skull here, obviously. The skull consists of several different bones. Now, you don't have to know every skull bone, but do you have any idea how many skull bones there are? Well, it's not too far off. 22. 22 skull bones overall. But the skull consists of two major parts, each of which contains multiple bones. The two parts of the skull are the cranium and the face. So don't use cranium and skull interchangeably either. The cranium is just part of the skull, just like the arm is only part of the upper limb. The cranium, there's 8 bones in that. And the cranium is otherwise called the brain case, because all 8 of those bones, only some of which you have to know, all 8 of those bones are in contact with the brain. Okay? The rest of the skull bones are not in direct contact with the brain. Instead, they are bones that hang on to the front of the cranium, and they therefore make up what is called the facial bones. And so those are the rest of the 22. There's 14 facial bones and 8 cranial bones for a total of 22 skull bones. We're looking at a side view here, or a lateral view, and it's good to have these colors. Obviously a real skeleton isn't colored, but the green one here is the parietal bone. Now, there's not just one of those. Some of these skull bones are paired, some of them aren't. The ones that are unpaired are right on the midline. The ones that are paired are on one side and the other. But this word parietal, where else do you use this? Where else have we talked about the word parietal? You're not allowed to forget the first test material just because you've taken the test. We talked about serous membranes, right? What are the 2 parts of a serous membrane? Have you ever heard of a serous membrane? Okay, so you remember that. There's 2 membrane layers to it, right? Like the fist in the balloon. The parietal layer, which is the part that directly wraps around the organ being enclosed by the serous membrane. And then the visceral layer, which is in direct contact. And then the outer layer, the superficial to that, is the parietal layer. Well, parietal means like a wall. So it's the outer wall of the serous membrane. That's why it got that name. In terms of the parietal bones of the skull, they form the side walls of the cranium. So that's why they were called that. What about the temporal bone? There's 2 of those, right and left. You're looking at which one here, by the way?
Right.
That's the right temporal bone, the orange one. What about that word? What does temporal mean? As opposed to spatial. Spatial means in space. Temporal means in what? Not space, but time. Temporary, right? Contemporary, those all involve time. And temple. These are the temples of the head, right? That's why this temporal got its name. But why are they called the temples? What does that have to do with time? Well, in men especially, this is the first place where you start graying your hair, giving an indication of your age, giving an indication of time. That's why they got that name. So the orange ones are temporal. You have to know those. The occipital bone, there's only one of those because it's right on the midline in the back. So this is the occipital bone. This is one way, if you're confronted with a skeleton, that all you have is the skeleton and you don't know the identity of the person, one way to sex it, not the best way, but one way, is to see how big the bump is. There's a bump called an occipital protuberance that males have a bigger one in general than females do, but you can feel it even if you're a female. That's one way of sexing a skeleton. I'll mention some others in a minute. The frontal bone, there's also only one of those, but like I said, it starts out as 2, which is why on a fetal skull you'll see it as 2 with a fontanelle in between, but it eventually becomes one solid bone. The zygomatic bone is the blue one here, 2 of those right and left. And on the skeletal model, it's this one right here. Well, zygomatic, the zygo part of that, just in zygote, means yolk, Y-O-K-E, not Y-O-L-K. What is a yolk, a Y-O-K-E? Anyone know? None of you drives a a team of oxen. The bar that holds two oxen together, you know what I'm talking about? That's called a yoke. You yoke them together. You're tying them together. And this bar right here, which is called the zygomatic arch, is kind of like an oxen yoke. That's why it was called that. But a zygote, which you started your life out as, is called that because you tied your parents tied together their two gametes, egg and sperm, to produce that zygote. Okay, and then you also have to know the two maxillae. Maxilla is the singular. Maxillae, with an E at the end, is the plural. So there are three overall jaw bones. And that's because the two maxillae, right here, stay separate bones throughout your life. They don't fuse together into one bone. The mandible, like I said earlier, starts out as right and left halves, but they become one bone, so there's really a total of three. The mandible is the lower jawbone. The two maxillae are the upper jawbones. All right, let's go to 17. Actually, there's no new bones listed here at all. These are just different views of them. See a good view of the frontal bone, the fact that it's one bone. Good view of the occipital bone, but all the information is the same otherwise. So let's go to 18. Now we're out of the skull and into the rest of the skeleton. First one shown here is the hyoid bone. Now hyoid comes from a Greek word that means U-shaped, which you can tell this better if you were looking at this from the top. The hyoid bone is U-shaped. It's right here in the model. It has a special claim to fame. Does anyone know what that is? It's true of it, but no other bone in the body. The hyoid bone is the only bone that does not articulate. To articulate means to form a joint with another bone. And that's why these full models that are connected are called articulated skeletons. So that's why on an articulated skeleton, the hyoid just has to be wired here where it is roughly in place in a living person. But it's not making an actual joint with the vertebrae. It's up here below the mandible. The mandible is kind of U-shaped, and then there's a smaller U-shape in there. And it's held in place there's a bunch of soft tissue around it, no bones. So it's a connection point. The hyoid bone itself is a place for a bunch of muscles to connect to that are important in the operation of your throat. Brings us to the vertebral column, or spine. You can call it the spine, but don't call the vertebral column the spinal cord. Those are two totally different things, right? The spinal cord is part of the nervous system. It's specifically part of the central nervous system. Central nervous system is brain and spinal cord. And then the peripheral nervous system is all the nerves that connect to the central nervous system. Well, the central nervous system has to be very well protected, obviously. And it is, because you have the cranium or brain case enclosing the entire brain. And the spinal column or vertebral column encloses the spinal cord. But notice the difference. The cranium, even though it's multiple bones that come together at joints called sutures, those sutures are examples of immovable joints. You don't want those cranial bones moving around, right? You want it to be basically one big solid case. On the other hand, the spinal column or vertebral column does move. Those joints move. But it still is very well protective of the spinal cord, because it's made up of many bones, each of which can move only very slightly with respect to the one next to it. And that keeps it pretty well enclosed, right? If it moved a lot, you would be vulnerable to damaging the spinal cord inside it. But since it only moves a tiny bit, it's very well protected. And since there's a lot of vertebrae, all those little bits of movement add up to quite a bit of bendability without damaging your spinal cord. Now, the overall thing is called the vertebral column, but there are different categories of vertebrae, plural of vertebra, an individual vertebral bone is called a vertebra. There are different categories of them, which we'll look at starting superiorly and working inferiorly. There are cervical vertebrae in the neck. Well, what is cervical an adjective of? Cervix, which means neck. A narrowing, right? You have a cervix. If you have a uterus, you have a uterine cervix. Well, the cervix of the uterus is called that for the same reason. It's the narrow part of the uterus. This is the narrow part between the head and the trunk, so it's called the cervix as well. And therefore, the bones of the neck are called cervical vertebrae. Now, these cervical, any vertebra can be called by its full name, like a cervical vertebra, but individual bones can also be referred to by an alphanumeric shorthand notation, a letter and a number. There are 7 overall cervical vertebrae, so they are numbered starting at the superior end, C1 through C7. Inferior to that are 12 vertebrae called thoracic vertebrae. So T1 through T12 come next. And the thoracic vertebrae are named for that's an adjective of thorax, which is the chest, right? The thoracic vertebrae are the 12. The reason that there are 12 thoracic vertebrae is that there are 12 pairs of ribs. And the thoracic vertebrae have the additional job beyond enclosing the spinal cord, they have the additional job of articulating with or forming a joint with the ribs, the 12 ribs. So there are 12 thoracic vertebrae, T1 through T12. Then working inferiorly, there is the lumbar set of vertebrae. Lumbar means of the lower back. You already learned that. That's one of your 9 regions, right? Two of your 9 regions, left and right lumbar. But anyway, L1 through L5 make up the lumbar vertebrae. Now, I'll get to the other 2 types in a second. But these first 3 groups, those all each consist of multiple vertebrae that remain separate bones throughout your lifetime. C1 through 7, T1 through 12, and L1 through 5. Okay, if you find that you can't remember how many are in each set, they're just like a lot of anatomy. There are mnemonic devices that can help you remember these. And one that seems to work well with people is that you have breakfast at 7, lunch at noon or 12, and dinner at 5, if that helps you use it. But there are 7 cervical, 12 thoracic, and 5 lumbar. There's 2 more categories of vertebrae, as you see, sacral and coccygeal, which is the adjective of coccyx. But even though they start out each as multiple bones, so there's 5 sacral bones originally, those 5 fuse into one piece called the sacrum, which is this thing right here. That's the 3rd bone of the pectoral girdle I was talking about, the part that is part of the axial skeleton, even though these are not. So that's the sacrum, and then the coccyx starts out as 2 or 3 bones in people, but they fuse together into one coccyx. And you have the overall vertebral column. Now, there's different curvatures in each of these regions as well. So it's not a straight vertical column, right? There's curvature in the cervical region, in the thoracic region, and in the lumbar region, and this is the normal curvature. But those curvatures, things can go wrong with those curvatures pretty commonly in people. And so there's different names depending on where the error in curvature is. If it's a sideways curvature, which there shouldn't be any, it should be straight up and down sideways. But if there's sideways curvature, that's scoliosis, which you've probably heard of. If there's an exaggerated thoracic curvature, which would be a hunchback, that is kyphosis. And if there's an exaggerated lumbar curvature, too extreme this way, that's lordosis. Anyway, those are vertebrae. I mean, that's the overall vertebral column. Now let's look at individual vertebrae. Slide 20 is just showing you an average vertebra. They're all slightly different from each other, not only in size but in shape. But any given vertebra is going to have a big hole in it, or a hole of some size in it. You don't have to remember that this is called a vertebral foramen. Foramen is just a word that means hole in a bone. But it makes sense that each vertebra has to have a hole in it, right? Because that's all of those holes line up to make a big tunnel, which is where the spinal cord is. And so there's a completely bony ring around it protecting that spinal cord. But then obviously there would be a gap that would otherwise expose the spinal cord until you get to the next vertebra, right? Well, that's filled in by tough material as well. So it's almost a complete encasement, even though it can still move. The body of the vertebra is the part that is the weight-bearing part of the bone. And so you see the body here. You're looking at it from the top. Each individual vertebra has a body. And between the two bodies of two vertebrae that are next to each other in the column, you have a very tough pad of fibrocartilage. These are individually called the intervertebral discs, discs between vertebrae. Right? And so this is very tough stuff in itself, but it's still pliable because it's not bony material. So a little bit of movement between the two bones occurs, and all of those add up to a lot of possible movement. So when people talk about a slipped disc, that does not actually happen. What it really is a herniated disc, and part of it bulges out and pushes on spinal nerves that are right here in the area, and that causes a hell of a lot of pain. But the disc does not slip out of place. That would sever your spinal cord and be bad, very bad news. It doesn't slip, by the way, because that fibrocartilage gets a very good hold on the bony material of the vertebral body. And that's why this looks so rough. It's not a nice smooth surface, right? If you're making a wood joint, you don't want, or not even just wood, anything that gluing two pieces of metal together for that matter, you don't want it to be nice and smooth, right? Because it'll easily break. You want to rough it up before you glue it together so there's a bunch of nooks and crannies for it to adhere to well. That's exactly why you have that roughness on these vertebral bodies. Now, let's look at some vertebrae from each of the regions. In 21, we're looking at the superiormost cervical vertebrae, and they can be called C1 and C2, like I said. But for these two particularly, they also have special names because they're kind of a special case. C1, the first superiormost cervical vertebra, is also called the atlas, named after Atlas from mythology, famous for what? Holding up the globe, right? The earth, the planet. Well, the atlas, being the superiormost vertebra, is holding up the globe that we call the skull. So that's why it was called atlas. It's also unlike all the other vertebrae because it does not have a body. But it does have a complete ring of bone around the spinal cord. It also has the biggest hole in it. As you go down the spinal column, each vertebra has a hole in it for the spinal cord, but that hole gets smaller and smaller as you go down the vertebral column, which makes sense because the spinal cord gets narrower and narrower. Since it's like a big cable of many, many nerves. Some of those come out as you go along, and the more that come out, the fewer that are left in it. So it gets narrower and narrower as it goes down. So the hole, that vertebral foramen that it's called, gets smaller and smaller. But the bodies, which is the weight-bearing part, get bigger and bigger, which makes sense also, right? Because the farther down you get, the more it's holding up above it. And so the lumbar vertebrae, L5, has a very big body. It's bearing a lot of weight. Okay, well, so that's atlas, C1. C2 is also specially named. It's the axis. The atlas, since it's in direct contact with the skull, allows for rocking the skull front and back. In other words, nodding your head yes. That's between the skull and the atlas. The axis is called this because there's a pivot point on it, like an axle. And it allows for twisting of the atlas compared to the axis. And so that allows for the no movement of your head. When you shake your head, no, that's between the atlas and the axis. The other ones don't have individual names. They're just called C3 through C7. But we see a typical one in 22. This is a typical cervical vertebra. If you had just a bunch of vertebrae on a table and you had to identify which category they belong to, well, the cervical vertebrae are the really easy to tell apart from the thoracic and the lumbar. And that's because the cervical vertebrae are the only ones with three holes. Every vertebra has that one hole for the spinal column or spinal cord, but there's two additional holes on each of the seven cervical vertebrae, and only the seven cervical vertebrae have these. Those are passageways for major blood vessels. 23 is a picture of an isolated thoracic vertebra. Notice it only has the one hole, like I was saying. So if you ask yourself the question, does it have three holes? The answer is yes, you have a cervical vertebra. If the answer is no, all you know is that it's not cervical. So the next question is it thoracic or is it lumbar? And you can't really tell from size because, for instance, the T12, the lowermost thoracic, is basically the same size as L1. So it's a little bit more difficult to tell those. But one trick that works pretty well is that when you look at them from the side, most thoracic vertebrae look like giraffe heads. Whereas, as you see in 24, most lumbar vertebrae viewed from the side look more like moose heads. And that's a pretty good trick, actually. It works pretty well. But you can see that these lumbar vertebrae that we're looking at here have a much bigger body than they have a vertebral foramen, because by the time you get that low, actually the spinal cord has already ended officially by the time you get down that far, but there's still nerves that come out of it, off of it, and go down through that hole. The sacrum, shown in 25, is pretty easy. It's obviously distinct from all the other vertebrae. And when you look at it, notice that there are four pairs of holes. That shows you that originally there were five individual bones. The holes are between the bones. And so five, what were individual sacral vertebrae, fused into the one sacrum. And you also have the coccyx here, which can be 2 to 4 bones, depends on the human originally, but they all fuse together anyway, so it ends up being one coccyx. Otherwise known as the tailbone, which you might have landed on and hurt. That takes a long time to heal if that ever happens to you. Okay, now to 26. We're looking at the rib cage here. There are 12 overall pairs of ribs, 24 ribs in total. 12 pairs, though. And they are numbered 1 through 12 from superior to inferior, just like the vertebrae are numbered. And they're all in association with the thoracic vertebrae. That's why there's 12 thoracic vertebrae. But there are three major categories of ribs. The superior most, seven of them, or seven pairs, 1 through 7, are called true ribs. Now, obviously, they're all ribs, but the phrase true ribs refers to the fact that they are connected not only to the vertebrae, as all ribs are, but also they're connected in the front via a band of hyaline cartilage to the sternum. That's true for the first seven. They each have their own hyaline cartilage band. And also notice that those seven are the only ones I won't even say that. They have their own cartilage band, okay? The next four next 5, 8 through 12, are called false ribs because they do not have their own band of cartilage that goes straight to the sternum. But some of them do have cartilage in the front. Okay? 8, 9, 10, these three, do have a band of cartilage, but notice that that cartilage is really just connected to another rib's cartilage. It doesn't connect directly to the sternum. So those are false ribs, and so are 11 and 12, but 11 and 12 are a special case of false ribs called floating ribs, because they connect only to the vertebrae, and they don't connect at all in the front. These right here. Okay? Okay, let's go to 27. The two that you have to know here are clavicle and scapula. We've already talked about those. They make up the pectoral girdle. In this view, we're looking at the front of the scapula, but to look at the front of it, you have to look through the rib cage. When you look at your isolated bones, notice that the anterior or the front of the scapula is the totally smooth part. When you look at it from behind, like we were seeing in 28, we see that it's much differently shaped. But that's the scapula, and so is 29 from the front, the smooth part. 30. Now we're in the limbs. This is the bone of the arm, or brachium. This is the humerus. And just for all these bones, when you finally are working in lab with each other and taking them out of the box, look at how they differ front and back, for instance, and how the right one, how you can tell a right one from a left one, for instance. And also, just don't forget that these full articulated skeletons are there. So each bone that you look at in isolation from the box, put it up there to the full skeleton and orient it in space. See how it's arranged. But that's the humerus. Another view, that's the back view of the humerus in 31. There's only one arm bone in each limb, or brachial bone. There are two antebrachial bones in each limb, so four overall. The two bones, though, are called the radius and the ulna. The ulna is the one that makes a hinge joint with the humerus that allows you to bend your elbow like this. You can see that right here. The radius runs parallel to the ulna when you're in the anatomical position, which, remember, is this. But you can do this with your... It seems like you're doing this with your hands, right? This is called pronation and supination. We'll talk about that later. Seems like you're doing that with your hands, but really what you're doing is rotating the radius. And since the distal part of the radius is connected to the hand gets dragged along. But it's rotation that occurs between the radius and the humerus, actually. And when that happens, the forearm goes from having ulna and radius in parallel to having them crossed over each other. Thirty-three, bones of the hand or manus. As I said before, the carpus is the wrist. That's part of the hand. That's the bones right here. There are 8 of them. They have individual names, but you don't have to know those individual names. It's really, they're arranged in 2 rows of 4, as you see here. And then beyond that are the metacarpals. Those are the bones of the palm. Don't mistake those for fingers. And then the finger bones themselves are phalanges. There's 14, not 15, because the thumb has only 2 and all the others have 3. Yeah.
We already kind of passed it, but I learned like a trick to remember like where the radius is, because if you go like this, it's like this, the R.
Oh, yeah, that's cool. I never heard that one.
For pronation, it's pouring. So you pour, supination is like you're holding a bowl of soup.
And yeah.
You pour for pronation.
Well, I've never heard the pour. I've heard like eating soup with a spoon is supination, because doing this is supination. By the way, also, you can tell that it's the radius that actually moves and not the ulna. If you put your elbow on the table, that's the ulna there. And you can rotate, you can pronate and supinate, and nothing's happening to your ulna, right? It's only the radius that's moving. Okay, so this is why there's 56 phalanges. There's 14 in each hand, so that's 28, and there's 14 in each foot. So just like there's only two in the thumbs and three in the fingers, there's two in each great toe or big toe, and three in all the other toes. So 28 manual phalanges, 28 pedal phalanges, 56 overall, over a quarter of the skeleton's bones. I'm just going to quickly finish these up, and then we'll break. We'll start lab just a little bit later, just for the sake of finishing this up. I'm almost done. In 34, we're looking at the pelvic girdle, the sacrum, and the two os coxae. This band of fibrocartilage that's between the two os coxae, that's tough stuff. It's the same material as the intervertebral discs. But in a female, hormonally during childbirth, that can be loosened up, which allows the two os coxae to move apart slightly from each other. And this makes the birth canal bigger, which is why giving birth is so easy. I usually get a sneer when I say that. That brings up, though, the much better way of sexing a skeleton. I told you about the occipital protuberance. A much better way, much more reliable way, because you can't rely on size. There are big women and there are small men. Better way is to look at the angle made right here. If this is a U shape, then it's a female. If it's more of a V shape, it's a male. And still, a third way is with the mandible, although this isn't as reliable as the other ways. This angle right here is straighter in a male and more rounded in a female, but there's variations, right? There's some feminine males and there are some masculine females. Now, 35, speaking of the os coxa, that's the name of the overall bone in adulthood, but it starts out as three bones that fuse together. And notice on your list that you have to know the three parts. These are the only examples of things that you have to know parts of bones rather than just the overall name. And the three are shown in red here. The three parts of each os coxa are the ilium, the ischium, and the pubis. The ilium is the biggest part, but it's also the superior part. And you can kind of feel the top of them. The ischium is the rounded part in the back, and so when you sit down, you're actually sitting on the ischia, which is the plural of ischium. Of course, there's some padding there, muscles and fat to pad it, but you're sitting right here on the ischium. And then the pubis, which the plural is pubes, are the parts that come together in the front. Right here, that part I was talking about that loosens up in women, that's where the two pubes come together. 36 just gives you a picture of what I told you before. In a male, it's more of a V shape than it is a U shape, because nothing has to pass through it in the male, right? Or no baby does. Feces do, but that's much easier. That head has to go through that birth canal, and so it's much bigger in a female. 37, this is not a leg bone, right? This is a thigh bone. The largest bone in the skeleton is the femur. There's one per lower limb. And so notice that it's different from front and back when you look at it. That's 37 and 38. And then 39 is the leg itself. Two bones of the leg in each lower limb. And those are the tibia and the fibula. Now, speaking of those, there's no such word as fibia, and there's no such word as tibula. It's tibia and fibula. And the tibia is much bigger than the fibula. And it's the only one that the femur connects to. So that's why the tibia have to be much bigger. They're actually bearing the weight. All the weight above it is put onto the tibia, not the fibula. The fibula only connects to the tibia, proximally, and then to the ankle bones, or the tarsal bones that would be down here in the foot, distally. So the fibulae are situated lateral to each tibia, and they are like struts in a car. They don't bear your weight, but they support when you shift to the side. And then you have the foot itself in slide 40. The overall foot is the pedis, but it contains the ankle, which is the tarsus. Unlike the hand, in which there are 8 carpal bones making up the wrist, there are only 7 tarsal bones making up each ankle. And otherwise, the numbers are the same. There are 5 metatarsals beyond the tarsals, making up your arch, and then 14 phalanges, because the great toe, as it's called, which is also digit number 1. The digits are also numbered. You start with the thumb in the hands, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You start with the great toe, or what you call the big toe, in the foot, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So this is why the overall foot bone number is 2 fewer than the overall hand number, because there's 1 fewer tarsal than carpal in each of the 2 feet. And I think that's probably the last slide. Yeah, it is.